From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We like to name months here in the U.S. April alone commemorates everything from jazz appreciation to lawn care. Yesterday, we heard about new research into baby vocal development that coincides with Autism Awareness Month. Today, we'll note two more attempts to raise awareness about important topics. April is also Sexual Assault Awareness Month and Financial Literacy Month. First, though, let's revisit something we discussed with AJC political reporter Jim Galloway yesterday. We talked about political rallies that have grown increasingly contentious, sometimes even violent, during this election year. We wondered if you would attend one or if you have some safety concerns. So here are your first thoughts. One big dog fan tweets this from Forsyth, Georgia. I would never attend a Trump rally, especially with the violence and anger that is brewed in those rallies. We always love to get your opinion. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OSD Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Governor Nathan Deal signed a bill into law this week that could expedite processing of rape kits in sexual assault cases. We've talked before about the backlog of kits on this show. Today, let's talk about the problem of rape itself. 107 seconds from now, someone will be sexually assaulted in the U.S., and then 107 seconds after that, and then 107 seconds later. That's according to federal data analyzed by the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. But one Atlanta artist wants to get beyond the statistics. Jessica Caldas has taken to the city streets with a piece of chalk and an important message. She marks the ground with an X every 107 seconds to represent those affected by sexual violence. I met up with Caldas earlier this week on the Atlanta Beltline near Krog Street Market. I asked her about her project and how it's helped her deal with her own past as a victim of sexual abuse.
A huge part of my work is talking about things that are stigmatized in really casual ways, because my belief is that the conversation around them, having those conversations, is sort of what creates opportunity for change. People don't understand things like sexual assault or domestic violence very well because they're things that people don't talk about regularly. So my belief there kind of helped me get to a point where I did feel comfortable talking about my own rape in a public way. And it all kind of came to a head this spring with the rape kit bill that was being held up in the Senate.
So that's the bill in which they were trying to go ahead. Just so our listeners know, her watch is going to go off every 107 seconds, and she's going to make an X. So this is the bill that would have tried to get through the backlog of rape kits that are sitting stored in various police departments.
I actually lobbied with the Georgia Women's Policy Institute to help get it voted on before on sign day, and it got passed at like midnight. It was incredible, and it actually got signed in this morning. So it did pass.
And it's too bad that this isn't TV, because people would see that you're beaming.
It was incredible.
Which is the part that's making you so happy? Is it the fact that these rape kits, I mean, it has to be more than just that they're going to get tested.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that every kit's going to get tested. What the bill does is it just provides procedure and a way to count and kind of make accountable the whole process. I think what makes me so happy is that I took this, what felt like a big chance for myself to like share my story in a really public way, for something I believed in, but that I was very nervous about, and it kind of paid off. I've never felt so strong in my ability to actually change things. So I got to participate in policy and the legislative process, and I got to share this story and talk about it in a super public way, and people were very supportive and very excited, and all of that is just like, it just kind of, it's hard not to feel really good about it. So,
do you think what you're doing now, and we have how many marks so far since you've been in? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 marks just since you've been standing here.
Yeah.
Do you consider this to be performance art?
It is a kind of performative work, yeah. It's also, I call it social practice, because where I really hope the art happens is in the conversation. So far, no one's really stopped to talk to us, and that happens. But
people do stop and talk and ask you why you're making a mark.
Yes. But even if they don't talk, yes, there is a performative aspect to it. Honestly, the basic goal of the project is to honor all of these victims. I mean, to me, 107 seconds is dismal. It's a dismal number to hear, especially in a place like the United States, and we kind of pride ourselves on being so progressive or so great. But I know the truth is that we have a lot of work to do on a lot of the issues that I care about. So,
I mean, the U.S., even at a federal level, has been talking about and trying to address sexual assault for decades. Mm-hmm. And yet here we are still talking about a pervasive rape culture. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you believe we do have a rape culture and why it persists.
I do believe that there is a rape culture that persists in the U.S. I think that it's changed more in the past few years than I've seen. I've also just been paying attention a lot more probably in the past few years than I did before. But, you know, the White House, and there are politicians making really clear public effort to fight sexual assault. I think the ability for people to share stories in really public ways, social media is a huge, powerful tool for this. And I think people are just like,
well, I got, you know, just to push back a little bit, yeah. Social media, some people say, is actually perpetuating and strengthening rape culture, that because of all the cyberbullying, because
right.
of those private forums on 4chan and other places.
What happens is, if there's like sort of private spaces where people can then reinforce each other's beliefs and ideas about what rape is or what consent is or what is, you know, sexual about a woman or not, then yes, that's going to reinforce that culture. But also then what you have is people speaking out more broadly and publicly about these things and about how wrong those things are. So when somebody gets cyberbullied, there's actually a really incredible organization that's been created in the past year called Heart Mob. And it's basically an organization that's fighting to correct cyberbullying and to protect the people that speak out on these issues and to provide ways to protect yourself when you do speak out online, and to kind of like to deal with that issue. And I think that's a huge deal. Like, I don't know that something like that would have existed 5 years ago. So I'm pretty excited about things like that. And I think any space is going to have people that are not good, and that and I think ultimately you're going to deal with that in almost any space, whether you're online or you're in public, if you're in a city or if you're in the country or wherever, it's going to happen. So it's just knowing how to talk to people and being unafraid, I think, to engage and to be wrong or to be challenged. I mean, I get challenged a lot with the work I do, but I'm never quite afraid of it. I kind of always expect it, and therefore I get to have these great conversations with people. And being willing to talk to people, to provide an opportunity for education or awareness that maybe they wouldn't have experienced, is like, that's my bread and butter. I love it.
Yeah, how did you get past that fear? Because a lot of rape survivors are never fully comfortable being by themselves and being challenged in public, and that's an obstacle some people never overcome.
Hesitate to say that that's true for all, like for the majority of rape survivors. I think that actually I know a lot of survivors who are incredibly vocal and powerful. I could name, I'm like imagining these like four women I know right now who would like kick butt, and if anybody like, and do, when anybody challenges them, they like, they've told me stories about they're out with coworkers and people are telling rape jokes and they're like, hey, no, that's not okay, and here's why. And they like are very vocal in these settings where it could be very hard for them. And that's been my experience with the kind of survivors I've been able to engage with. But I also, of course, engage with people who are scared and who are afraid. And I think sort of my other strong belief is that you have to process these things however feels comfortable and right to you. Like, there's a lot of, I think, when you experience trauma, a need to be really careful with yourself and really understanding of what you need. So like, there were years I didn't talk to anybody about this, and now I do, and I don't regret the years I didn't talk about it. I don't regret whatever decisions I made when it happened, because I know that those were like what I needed at the time. Now I'm kind of this person who likes to like talk to people and have really hard conversations. That's my favorite thing in the world to do. And I like to be challenged even on the stuff that I'm like, well, I think you're wrong. I like that challenge, because then it's just more interesting that way. And then there's like, I often learn a lot when people disagree with me. And I think people learn a lot from me when they disagree as well. And that's the best thing. So I really believe in it.
What's the most common question you get when people stop? I mean, other than what are you doing, which I assume is the first question,
yes.
But what's the most common question after that?
People want to know a lot about statistics around reporting and prosecution, which are pretty dismal. So.
And yet there's a persistent myth that a large number of rapes are just women who regret having sex.
Right. That's a part of the rape culture that exists in our society, the lack of understanding of the nuances of consent. And, you know, I think some people would consider... some people would consider a lot of experiences I hear as being just, like, nights that somebody made a drunken mistake, but that's not reality. But that's a kind of an education thing. I'm a big believer in education as like another avenue for change. I think that sex education is really important, and not just talking about sex, but talking about consent and boundaries and healthy relationships, because I think all of that ties into our understanding of how we treat each other and how we express and understand empathy, and thus essentially how we eventually get to consent and understanding, like how to treat each other in sexual ways as well.
What have we missed? What have I not asked you?
You did ask me this question, like, what do people ask? The other thing people ask a lot about is like, well, who's committing these crimes? Or like, they have ideas about stranger rape, which is a huge myth as well, that stranger rape is the primary like thing to be afraid of. And the reality is 70% of rapes are committed by someone known to the victim. That's family, and that's friends, it's acquaintances, it's partners. You know, there's this whole constant battling of like, yes, you can be raped by somebody you're in a relationship with, because you can withdraw consent at any point. And those are things that people have a difficulty wrapping their brain
around.
Well,
that's a recent development. I mean, we've had hundreds of years in which it was legally impossible for a man to rape his own wife.
Right. I believe 1998 was the last year that a state changed its law so that a husband cannot legally rape his wife. I believe that's right. But also, even all of our statutes around sexual assault and these things are still outdated, because they often include language that's focused on female victims. And one of the things I'm also learning the more and more I research and the more people I talk to and the more I engage this project is people don't pay a lot of attention to male victims or to queer victims. These communities of color and communities, the LGBTQT communities are at an even higher risk than, you know, like white women or for that matter, white men. So these are all things that are kind of becoming more and more important, more and more researched.
That's Atlanta artist Jessica Caldas. She spoke with me on the Beltline earlier this week. You can see her chalk X's all around the city this month. She makes that mark every 107 seconds to represent those affected by sexual violence. This is On Second Thought. April is Financial Literacy Month. That was designated back in 2003, mostly because the Great Recession revealed just how little the average American knows about their finances. Only 5% say they learned about money in school, and about 40% would give themselves a C or lower grade for their understanding of personal finance.
Want to see my report card? Think I did good?
Well, I guess you did better than I did. I never got any Bs.
85% of Americans think we should teach about finances in high school. So, in the spirit of financial literacy, let's talk about something we hear a lot about, especially during election time. Social Security. It's something a lot of people talk about, but few people understand. So, it's time to break it down.
Ooh, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know.
Let me break it down for you again.
Break it down now.
Break it down.
Social Security is part of most people's retirement plan. Why is it important? Because there's a $6.6 $1 trillion gap between what Americans have saved for retirement and what they'll probably need in order to retire in relative comfort. But the idea of saving money in anticipation of a time when you're no longer able to work is a fairly new concept. The ancient Greeks used to stockpile olive oil in clay pots in case of sickness or adversity. But for most of human history, old age meant you needed a younger person to take care of you or you might get hosed.
Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No, I'm doing fine.
There were some very exclusive clubs that offered support for the needy and elderly, like the Freemasons and the Elks. Masons paid 25 cents each toward a fund to create a retirement center that housed poor members, their wives, widows, and orphans. And Civil War veterans could collect pensions from the government as well. But for most people, a comfortable retirement was out of reach. Until Black Tuesday. That's October 24th of 1929, and it's when the stock market crashed and the Great Depression began.
The tremendous crowds which you see gathered outside the stock exchange are due to the greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange in market prices.
It lasted 10 years. Unemployment was higher than 25% at times, and about 10,000 banks failed. So, Governor Huey Long of Louisiana proposed the Share the Wealth program. He wanted everyone over the age of 60 to collect a pension. By 1935, there were 7.7 million members in Share the Wealth clubs. The call for such a program was echoed by the popular preacher Charles Coughlin. At his peak, Father Coughlin's radio show had a larger audience than Howard Stern, Larry King, Rush Limbaugh, and Paul Harvey combined. Now, Coughlin was also an anti-Semite and racist, but he did help rally support for the idea of a social safety net.
With a dollar that is easily manipulated by the exploiters of labor, it is evident that higher wages mean nothing if they will not be able to purchase more of life's necessities.
But the Social Security program that we know today was modeled after the European system of social insurance. A large group of people put money into a pot that insures them against a defined risk, in this case, old age. Theodore Roosevelt was a big fan of the idea in the early 1900s, but it was Franklin Roosevelt that actually carried it out.
It proposes, by means of old age pensions, to help those who have reached the age of retirement to give up their jobs and thus give to the younger generation greater opportunities for work, and to give to all, old and young alike, a feeling of security as they look towards old age.
The Social Security Act was signed into law in August of 1935. It guaranteed most workers a decent income by the age of 65. Since then, the government has paid more than $7 trillion in benefits. The smallest check ever cut was 5 cents back in the late 1930s.
To take the ferry cost a nickel, and in those days, nickels had pictures of bumblebees on them. Give me 5 bees for a quarter, you'd say.
The program has been tweaked and updated since the 30s. It's been overhauled and revamped, but the core concept is still the same. Let's walk through a few of the myths surrounding Social Security, because there are a lot of them. Probably the biggest is that Social Security is going bankrupt. It is not.
Simple math says it all. The left primarily argues, well, no, Social Security isn't bankrupt. Look, bankrupt is when you can't pay your debts.
If no money is paid into the piggy bank, then the Social Security Trust Fund will be gone by 2033. But money is being paid into the system, and that will continue. So Social Security will not go broke. But unless Congress raises taxes or increases the retirement age to 70 years old, Social Security benefits will go down. A young person might collect only 75% of their expected benefits if Congress does not act.
Well, that's not fair.
I don't even know what that means.
Why does she get one and not me?
Because she's a separate person from you. You're never going to get the same things as other people. It's never going to be equal. It's not going to happen ever in your life. So you might as well learn that now, okay?
Another myth is that it's best to start collecting your benefits as early as you can. That's age 62. But the full retirement age is 67. You can start getting checks 5 years earlier, but your benefits go up by 8% for every year that you wait. Life expectancy for the average American is nearly 80, so you might want to be patient and get the bigger check when you most need it.
I used to be with it, but then they changed what it was. Now what I'm with isn't it, and what's it seems weird and scary to me.
Another myth dates back to the 1990s. It was debunked fairly quickly, but it still persists. Here's the claim. More young Americans believe in UFOs than think they will ever receive Social Security benefits.
There are alien forces acting in ways we can't perceive.
Nope, that's not true. Even back in the 90s, over 70% of young people had confidence in Social Security. Those young people are now in their 40s, like me. As of 2015, a Gallup poll found about half of Americans think they'll be able to collect Social Security, but only about a third expect it to be a major source of income after they retire. Those are the basics of Social Security. So for more detail, let's consult an expert. Joining me now is Mary Beth Franklin. She's contributing editor at Investment News and an expert on Social Security. Hi there.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me on today.
Did we get everything right?
I think you had a great summation of the history of Social Security. But the important thing is to look forward and what can we expect.
Can we go back to those myths that I talked about and start with the one about Social Security going bankrupt? Why does that myth persist?
Well, because there is this widespread information that the Social Security Trust Fund will run out of money around 2033. But we have to back up and say, really, what does that mean? Every one of us who has a paycheck has something called FICA taxes, which stands for Federal Insurance Contribution Act, taken out of their paycheck every week that is earmarked for Social Security benefits. And in addition, over the past 30 years, Congress made sure that we were collecting more tax revenue than we needed immediately, knowing that 78 million baby boomers were going to start retiring around now. So that way, they've got money from the FICA taxes and the extra revenue that was in this, quote, trust fund. Well, over the next 10 to 15 years, we'll be drawing down that trust fund to the point that if Congress did nothing, the trust fund would dry up, but the FICA taxes would continue. And even if Congress did nothing, there would be enough FICA taxes to pay about 75% of promised benefits. Well, hey, no one is going to be satisfied with 75%, and I guarantee that Congress will do something because it's the most popular federal program in history, and more importantly, old people who get the benefits vote in higher percentages than other people.
Now, Social Security, though, although a lot of people end up relying only on Social Security, financial experts say it's not enough to actually let somebody retire in comfort. Isn't that correct?
Correct. It was never intended to be your sole form of retirement income. For a low-income worker who has low wages throughout his or her life, it would replace about 40% of their paycheck. For a higher-income worker, it might replace 25% of your former paycheck. So you really need to do something on your own. In the past, many of our parents were lucky enough to have pensions from their employers. That's pretty much gone the way of the dinosaur at this point. So we are more personally responsible for our retirement, and that means funding your 401k plan, your 403b plan, your IRA, whatever you have access to, and the sooner the better.
All right, let's go back to what Congress can do or cannot do. I mentioned that they've considered raising the retirement age, but they've been bouncing that around for a really long time. What are the ideas on how to keep Social Security from decreasing benefits?
Basically, it will have to be a combination of some sort of revenue increase and some sort of benefit reduction. But let me give you an example. You mentioned that the full retirement age is 67. That really only applies to people who were born in 1960 or later, like you. I'm 61. My full retirement age is 66. This gradual increase in the full retirement age started back in 1983. We have gotten more than 30 years to get used to the idea that the full retirement age is going up. That 67 doesn't kick in until 2027. So when you make incremental changes and you give America a long time to get used to it, it's not so bad. So yes, Congress might increase the full retirement age to 70, but it would probably affect today's four-year-olds or younger. It's not going to affect you. The other
So that doesn't solve the whole problem.
It would solve a large piece of the problem. But in Congress, you have people who hate benefits cuts, which tend to be Democrats. You hate people who hate tax increases, which tend to be Republicans. So basically, you have to do a little bit of both and tick off everybody equally. So what you will probably have is currently 7.65% of everyone's paycheck funds Social Security and Medicare, and an equal amount of that comes from your employer. So the combination is 15.3%. If you increase that tax by about 2% on both sides of the equation, you have completely wiped out that long-term deficit. I don't think you would do it all on the tax side. Maybe you would do a little bit on the tax side and gradually increase the full retirement age. The dangerous conversations are around something called means testing. You have some
means,
people,
M-E-A-N-S.
Correct. In other words, if you have a lot of money, you shouldn't get Social Security benefits. That flies in the face of the entire concept of Social Security, which was every worker and their employer contributes a small amount of their paycheck to a future retirement benefit. If you now say to people, except if you're too rich, you're not going to get anything, well, suddenly you have gone from a shared earned benefit to some sort of welfare for the elderly. That is really not what this system is all about. And I think if you have someone try to impose that concept, you'd get a lot of pushback. And Social Security, which is so powerful and popular because it's shared by all, would be the ghettoization of Social Security. It would lose its clout.
So here's a question that I looked everywhere and could not find an answer to, Mary Beth. We just got news that millennials are now the largest generation of Americans. Now, when they discovered that the baby boomers was a huge number of people of all about the same age, Congress acted and they created the trust fund. So shouldn't we be preparing for the days at some point when the millennials grow older and are ready to retire?
Social Security, when you look at the demographics, it goes in waves. When Social Security was first created, there were 33 workers for every one retiree. Taxes were very low, benefits were low. Over the generations, we've now gotten to the point that there's only about two workers for every one retiree. That's why it's such a burden. But as the baby boomers die off, that's going to flip again. And there'll be plenty of workers for, you know, smaller groups of retirees. Congress just has to make a few minor tweaks to take care of these demographic changes. They come in waves. Social Security is a really simple mathematical fix.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mary Beth, but it sounds like what you're saying is after the generation of baby boomers, there's going to be a long period of time in which we're sort of refilling the coffers.
Correct.
And that will take care, if the Congress makes the changes that you've talked about, that will correct the trust fund problem.
For the foreseeable future, Social Security tends to look in 75-year increments, and they can tweak it as they go along. Social Security is now 80 years old. Couple minor tweaks, you're good for the next 75 years. And as times change and demographics change, a few other tweaks would keep it going.
Okay, so we only have about a minute and a half left, but can you speak to those people out there who don't think that they will ever collect any Social Security? Because there seems to be a good number of them.
You will definitely collect Social Security. It's a pay-to-play system. If you pay into the system, you're going to get benefits. But there are public workers in 15 states, some of whom are in Georgia, that do not pay into Social Security. They have a public retirement system. They won't get benefits. So, you know, if you are being taxed, you're going to get a benefit in the future. But the fact that your retirement age is a little higher than mine, it means your benefits will be worth a little less than mine. However, you're probably going to outlive me by 5 or 10 or 15 years. So in the long run, you're going to get more out of the system.
Because I'll be being paid for 5 or 10 years longer.
Exactly.
That is Mary Beth Franklin, clear as day. She is a contributing editor at Investment News. Mary Beth, thank you so much.
Happy to help.
This is On Second Thought. Georgia's first Ideal Church of Scientology opened its doors this month. The 45,000-square-foot mansion is located in Sandy Springs. That's just outside of Atlanta. Church spokeswoman Erin Banks spoke with Fox 5 Atlanta about the new church.
It's actually the newest Ideal Church of Scientology in the world. There are over 50 now. And an Ideal Church of Scientology is basically the realization of L. Ron Hubbard's vision for a Scientology church. So it's a church that not only can service the parishioners and Scientologists, but is a community home.
So Banks mentioned Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard there. We'll kind of learn more about him in a moment. But that sense of community she describes resonated with Joseph Bell of Atlanta. He first learned about the church in the mid to late 1980s.
There's no initiation where you just become a Scientologist, you know, kind of thing. You know, I mean, because I was Christian or just basically a non-denominational type of character, you know, just interested in knowledge on life. There wasn't any kind of time that I sort of became a Scientologist. It's more so that I was more committed to it, the more that I understood what it really was. You trust more the more you understand.
We asked Joseph Bell what it is about Scientology that really draws him.
I just extremely enjoy the humanitarian things that they do for the environment, with crime or illiteracy, you know, drug rehabilitation. These things are tools that I could use to help someone else. So when I found out more information about the mind and the spirit that I wasn't taught in school, it interested me.
Now, Bell is African-American, and that puts him in the minority. He says in the past few years, though, he has seen more diversity in his church.
Man, these are good times right now, because I was in Scientology back in the day when there was hardly nobody black. What I like to see now is that I'm not the only black person. There are a lot of black people that know about this. And it's very beneficial for our community and for other churches as well to, you know, to work together to make a difference, to do things that I'm certain that Martin Luther King, I'm certain that Malcolm X would stand for.
That's up for debate, I'm sure, but I'm joined now by journalist Tony Ortega. He runs a blog that is dedicated to Scientology. It's called The Underground Bunker, and he joins me on the line from California. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Can you explain the name of your blog, The Underground Bunker? Why is it called that?
Yeah, it just I was the editor-in-chief of The Village Voice, and I was writing a lot about Scientology. I've actually been studying and writing about Scientology for 20 years, but while I was at the Village Voice several years ago, I just sort of joked that I was writing from an underground bunker because Scientology has a reputation for being very tough on journalists, and it just sort of stuck. So I left The Voice, I wrote a book, I started this my own website, and so I gave it that name just, you know, because I knew my readers would find that familiar.
Now, when you say they've been tough on journalists, they've sued over half of them.
Oh, much worse than suing. I mean, my book is called The Unbreakable Miss Lovely, and it's about Paulette Cooper, who wrote one of the first books about Scientology in 1971 and nearly paid for it with her life. At one point, she was facing 15 years in federal prison for a crime she did not commit but was framed for by Scientology's spy organization. And, you know, Scientology is probably the only church in the world that has its own spy organization, but they do. And they've, you know, smeared journalists. They've really tried to mess with their lives. A man just went to prison recently for trying to illegally hack me on behalf of the Church of Scientology. So they're still attempting to do illegal things to people that write about the organization.
Now, you're joining us by Skype. I hate to joke about this, but you're not hidden somewhere, right? I mean, are you fearful for your own safety?
I'm actually in Los Angeles right now. I covered a court hearing in a Scientology lawsuit yesterday here, and I'm staying with my mother, who has been harassed and spied on by the Church of Scientology. And they're probably outside watching right now.
So I want to go back. One of the reasons that we were interested by this story of Scientology opening a church just outside Atlanta is because Scientology isn't, at least in the popular sphere, associated very much with people of color, and it's not often associated with Southernness either. How does Scientology do? Do we have a good idea at their demographics?
Scientology is very white. It's very white, and it's getting older and older. It, you know, Scientology has never had the numbers that it claims. My sources include top former executives who had access to enrollment documents. And they tell me that at its greatest height, around the year 1990, Scientology had about 100,000 people around the world. I just talked to an executive who left just 2 years ago who said that, and he also had access to enrollment documents. And he said that number is down now to less than 20,000 people around the world. It's a tiny organization, and it's always been very white, tends to be up middle class or upper middle class, because Scientology is very, very expensive. David Miscavige, the leader of the church, has tried to increase black involvement, and that has resulted in the strangest new relationship between the Church of Scientology and the Nation of Islam. Minister Louis Farrakhan has embraced Dianetics and has urged all of his followers to get trained in Dianetics, which is the first sort of step on the road to Scientology. And so
that's the book written by L. Ron Hubbard back in, I think, 1950. The subtitle was Modern Science of Mental Health. Go ahead.
May 1950. That's the book that started all this. L. Ron Hubbard came out with that book and said he had figured out the human mind for the first time. And it was very popular at first. And that book encourages you to clear away the traumatic memories from your earlier life just by simply sitting down and talking with another person. Later on, he developed something he called Scientology, which involves you trying to find traumatic memories from past lives, and it involves the use of an electronic meter. But that first book doesn't require that. It's very inexpensive, and the Nation of Islam has embraced that. Now, I haven't seen any true merging of those two organizations. I don't really see Nation of Islam members becoming members of Scientology's C organization, which is sort of their clergy.
What about Southern culture? Because, look, I'm from California. We did have a large number of facilities, Scientology facilities, around Los Angeles, where I grew up. But what kind of inroads has Scientology made into other areas of the country, especially the South?
It's not only almost non-existent in the South. David Miscavige himself said something really remarkable when he opened that new church the other day. One of our readers actually got a vantage point across the street and videotaped his entire speech, which we've never been able to do before. And so I posted that video on my website along with a transcription of what he said. And here's something he said during his speech, talking to the people in Atlanta. He said, "You are recently comprised of but a resolute few, and Southern wings have not yet stirred." That's an incredible.
Could you repeat that for me?
"You are recently comprised of but a resolute few, and Southern wings have not yet stirred." You have to understand, for David Miscavige to basically admit there are almost no Scientologists in Georgia is incredible. But it's the truth. There are just a very few number of Scientologists. Some of them are very wealthy. They're the ones who paid for this building something like 9 years ago. They bought it, and it took them forever to renovate it and open it. And I think there are probably maybe 200 Scientologists in the entire southern United States. I mean, it's just not popular there. It's not very popular anywhere. The two places where you might actually run into a Scientologist in the street are in Los Angeles and the Clearwater area in Florida. You're not going to run into Scientologists anywhere else. And as far as, like, you know, is there a southern flavor to it or anything? Each of these ideal orgs are beautifully renovated. They put a ton of money into it, and they always try to give it some local touches. So I have no doubt that people who go into the Atlanta org will see that they have made an attempt to try to blend in with Southern culture. But it's really important to remember something about Scientology. One of the most basic concepts of Scientology is that they call it standard technology delivered standardly. And what that means is they are following the teachings of L. Ron Hubbard to the letter. And the exercises they do, the courses they take, are going to be exactly the same whether it's in Tokyo, Japan, or Oslo, Norway, or, you know, Athens, Greece. And so even though they might have some superficial touches to try to convince you that they're somehow adapting to Atlanta and the South, they really aren't. If you're a Scientologist, you do Scientology the way L. Ron Hubbard described it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist and blogger Tony Ortega, and we are talking about the very first Ideal Church of Scientology that opened its doors this month just outside Atlanta in Sandy Springs. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have an opinion, you can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation happening at Facebook. When you're talking about the, following exactly the principles of L. Ron Hubbard and his book Dianetics, how different are these principles? Obviously, the South is largely, historically and even today, largely Christian. That's the vast majority of religious people in the South. How different are the principles of Scientology from the Christianity many people here are familiar with?
Couldn't be more different. You know, Scientology in a Christian church or a Jewish synagogue or, you know, a mosque.
Buddhist temple, yeah.
You go into a sanctuary and you have a leader who wants to make you feel part of something larger and tells you a story about something that happened 2,000 years ago on another part of the earth. And you all sort of learn from this idea of being part of a larger group. Scientology could not be more different. Scientology is about you and an auditor. It's just one-on-one. They put together
auditor,
a chapel.
You said auditor.
Auditor is just someone who listens. And it's basically their version of a counselor. They have a chapel. They put on a Sunday service. It's just for PR. What Scientology is you sit down with your auditor, and the auditor asks you questions about you, your life, and your memories. It's all about you. And it's very exciting for some people, the idea that there are these mysteries of the universe contained within your own past. And you're trying to remember things that happened to you, not just when you were a child, but when you were somebody on another planet billions of years ago. And they believe that they're able to accurately recall those memories with the use of this machine that they're holding that supposedly reads their minds. And so it's all about you. It's very narcissistic, and it's got nothing to do with God or religion or prayer. In fact, L. Ron Hubbard is on tape saying that Jesus Christ never existed. And Scientology will tell you that you can still be a Christian and be a Scientologist, or you can be a Jew and be a Scientologist. But the truth is, very soon after you get into it, they start talking to you about dropping what they call other practices. And it is not compatible with other belief systems.
Do they proselytize, though? Are we supposed to recruit new members? Are we supposed to see this church in Atlanta as an attempt by the church to bring in Southerners, to bring in people of color?
Absolutely. They have a whole division that they call Division 6, which is reaching out to the public. And they have everything standard. They're going to reach out to you the same way they do in New York or Portland or Minneapolis. They have just routines they do. They'll put out a table and put up a sign saying free stress test or free personality test. Learn about yourself. Again, it's all about you. And they want you to come in and take a test. They tell you a lot of things about it being an applied philosophy, helping you unleash your potential. They're not going to tell you that if you get into it deeply enough, you'll eventually be paying hundreds of dollars an hour for counseling that helps you remove the remaining dead souls of aliens that are attached to you, which is what you do in the upper levels. They never tell you what's coming down the road until you're well indoctrinated. But yes, they will be reaching out. They will be setting up tables. This particular Ideal org they opened in is in a really unfortunate place. There's no foot traffic. I actually got a photograph recently where they had a single staff member standing out on the street there in Sandy Springs with a sign pointed at traffic saying open house. I guarantee you that place is going to be just completely empty and will generate no new members.
So if you are a member of the Scientologist Church and you are poor or you become poor, do you get dropped?
Well, there's an option. First of all, they don't want you if you're poor. They don't want you if you're disabled. They don't want you if you have debts. Which they check out. I mean, that's
part of they do a background check on perspective.
They absolutely do. But one option you can have if you don't have a lot of money is you can join staff, or you can join what's called the C organization, which is the most hardcore inner group. You have to sign a billion-year contract, but if you join the C
org, is that a joke? Billion?
No. It says I commit myself for the next billion years. Because I don't know if I explained this. The basic beliefs of Scientology is that we're immortal beings called Thetans that just happen to be walking around in this current body, but you've lived countless times in the past, you'll live countless times in the future. And so once you join the Sea Org, you're basically promising that you will come back lifetime after lifetime to serve Scientology for the next billion years. And, you know, theoretically, your courses are free if you do that. Okay, then you can take these really expensive courses for free. The problem is, if you join the Sea Org, you're going to be working 112 hours a week for about 40 cents an hour. And you won't be seeing any of your family or friends for the next, you know, years. You get maybe 2 or 3 days off a year. So they just literally don't have time to take these courses. I've talked to people that were in the Sea Org for 15 years who had still never even gotten into the middle courses of what's called going up the bridge because they just didn't have time.
And we'll have to end it there, but it's fascinating. That is journalist Tony Ortega. He covers the Church of Scientology, and he's been doing it for 20 years. His blog is called The Underground Bunker. Tony, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That's our show for today, but I want to return to this issue of Social Security. We talked about that earlier, and I wonder if you think Social Security will be there for you when you retire, or do you believe it will go bankrupt? Will you get enough to support yourself? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter, at OST Talk, or post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.